Just a few reflections before we sit in meditation. It's good to reflect on the difference between information and insight. Like Buddhism is such a vast and rich teaching, you can study it for many PhDs and many lifetimes. But the accumulation of information isn't the same as reflection. As Ajahn Sumedho has a talk in that book, Don't Take Your Life Personally, knowledge doesn't crack it, doesn't crack the puzzle. And that's the seduction of intellect, is that you think if you read more, you'll know more. If you study more, you'll know more. But I think all of us have met people who are very clever with Buddhist ideas, but in fact suffer a lot, either through being very opinionated or all manner of suffering. So the end of suffering doesn't come about through the accumulation of information. I think that's obvious. But to take some aspect, but to have no information, to have no teaching, and just sort of go it alone would be a loss, because there is a teaching, there is information, there is a whole structure of contemplation that we can use. So the contemplative takes some aspect of the teaching and then tries to make it personal, try to take it into the reality of your own life. And that contemplative or reflective part is what leads to insight, whereas the accumulation of information leads to, that's what scholars would do, that would be their work. They would accumulate different translations, and that's very valuable for us to have access to scholarly works. But we're not interested in here scholarship. We're interested in just enough study to be able to observe life through a lens that the Buddha would approve of. So if I have studied a little bit, Four Noble Truths, cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and then I use that as a way of observing my own experience, then that's the contemplative life. And then hopefully through that kind of observation, I gain the insights that the Buddha had. I begin to see like the Buddha sees. And then that's his path to freedom. So you have a path, a Buddhist path, but without the reflective or contemplative mind, I don't think it works. So when religious folk argue about the Buddha said this or the Buddha said that, as a piece of scholarship, okay, that's what scholars might do. I remember I was once at a talk in New Zealand, in Wellington, where the religious studies department had invited a professor from Hawaii to give a kind of keynote talk. And I didn't usually go to those kind of academic things. I didn't find them all that interesting. So I listened, and it was clever. You know, what he gave was clever. And then there was another professor who was also clever. And then they started to argue. And they started to exchange cleverness. And I just watched this. I didn't know what they were talking about half the time. And I realized they just enjoyed being clever. So it was a kind of intellectual dueling. Gotcha. Sort of. But I didn't feel there was much wisdom in it. There wasn't much wisdom at all. And then I found out later that one of the contestants in this intellectual jousting was actually a very troubled person. Had a lot of troublesome family life and a lot of difficulties. And so I thought, well, what happened to the Four Noble Truths? Another person I met who was studying Buddhism somewhere, he said that his professor it was almost like the professors shouldn't believe in Buddhism to teach Buddhism. You know, kind of, you can't believe in this stuff, do you? So you teach it. So that, not you know, when you get good scholarship, it's wonderful. So we have really good translators and scholars now that we can turn to see, oh, what did the Buddha say about this or that? But just to always accumulate information, I think is a misuse of the teaching. So the way I've been taught is to take a little bit and then try to really keep reusing it, keep re-reflecting on it, so that the insights become more and more grounded in my own experience and more profound from the teaching itself, what it's pointing to. So and this is my instruction from Lompo Sumedho and Lompo Cha, to take suffering and understand its cause and let go of the cause. Or to take something like three characteristics and delve into that deeply. Or to take the language around Nibbana, the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated. So, say that kind of language I've used for 40 years as a kind of contemplative mirror. And that kind of questioning has been very, very helpful. I remember once we were in a retreat center in Oxford. It was 1978, I think, and there were two ladies that were coming to our meetings. And after a year, they came up to us. They said, "Can you now give us the esoteric teaching?" They wanted the secret teaching, the real teaching. This is it, suffering and the end of suffering. So if you reinvigorate your intellect with a kind of foundation of suttas. So we've been chanting the three cardinal suttas in the evenings in English. Those are known as the three cardinal suttas, and they are kind of basic to the understanding of Theravada Buddhism. So what you do with study is you read these things over, and then you might write them down, memorize them even, some of the basic Pali words. So in terms of Four Noble Truths, tanha, you memorize that, craving, the three types of craving, and you keep reinforcing that in the mind by reading it. And then if you read it again and again and again, you already have the information. You've read it once. So, you know, flip the chapter and go to the next. No, you go back and you reinforce your reading. And in that kind of study, what you find is then that information begins to be a perception that comes up in ordinary life. So, like I've been suggesting on this retreat, bring forth the perception of change. Notice change. So hopefully, if I keep reinforcing that for you, you keep reinforcing that for yourself, and then your mind begins to function from that perception, the perception of change. And then as you begin to interpret life or look at life through that perception, you begin to practice what the Buddha's asking you to do. And that's not a belief. So I think the whole teaching around change is very much left as a belief in Buddhism. So, the Buddha said everything changes, and so, yeah, okay, everything changes, I agree. But that's not contemplation, that's agreement. And none of us are stupid to think, no, you know, the leaves are permanent, or this body is permanent. You know, we're more intelligent than that. But that ongoing perception and practice of this is uncertain, or perceiving change, is something that is done from the contemplative or reflective mind rather than the believing mind. So as a card-carrying Buddhist, I might believe in karma, you know, I might believe in anicca, dukkha, anatta, I might believe in the Four Noble Truths, and that would be my credentials to say I'm a Buddhist. But if I didn't use them, then I'm just a believer, which is better than maybe not believing, I don't know. But it's not the same as the kind of contemplative attitude. And that's what the forest tradition has always encouraged us to do. So Ajahn Chah, he said, study enough, but don't don't think that study in itself is sufficient. Sometimes in Buddhism, we can be very in awe of people who have high attainments in scholarship. I certainly am. I can feel very intimidated by it. But then I realize, well, knowledge is one thing, but wisdom is another thing. So I've met monks in Thailand whose knowledge base is limited compared to someone who's has a lot of information, but the profundity of their silence, their stillness, their compassion is just very touching at a way which is not just around thought. And then I've met other people who are very clever, and they can argue circles around anything I say, and I can feel very sort of, gee, I don't know what he's talking about kind of feeling, and feel intimidated by that. But then I walk away, I think, well, that wasn't compassion, that was domineering. You know, that wasn't really a discussion. That was a joust, and I lost. You know what I mean? I think the practices of like the contemplative life is a kind of inner conversation which you're holding with yourself and the teaching. Yeah, it's like it's not just a fixed thing. Okay, now I know Anicca. No, you're constantly having this conversation with the teaching and your environment and your situation. So what is it, you know, what's unchanging, say? That's a conversation I have with myself all the time. What is it that knows? How is this changing? And then I observe from that kind of inner dialogue. And that is constantly encouraging the contemplative mind. And so meditation, you know, we use this word a lot, meditation. Meditation for me would be learning to ground yourself in the present moment for long spans of time by using meditation objects or whatever. And so a retreat like this or formal practice that we do, it is very important because it gives us the sort of parami and tools and situation where we can strengthen our capacity to be present to the way things are. But just to do that, just to be peaceful, and then not be able to apply that to the complexities of life would be a waste of time, wouldn't it? You know, might as well just go to the movies kind of thing. So the way I've always learned to practice is like, it's all practice. Whatever's happening, whether I like it or not, it's all practice, work, not work. And then constantly keeping a sense of inner vigilance and inner contemplation. And it's not just thinking about myself, because that would be narcissistic. If I was just thinking about myself all the time, that's not Dharma. That's thinking about myself all the time. A kind of narcissism which can exist in spiritual life. My practice and my insights and, you know, that kind of obsession with a sense of self. But it's actually the very opposite. It's looking at Dharma as not self. The Dharma of pain, the Dharma of inspiration, the Dharma of doubt, the Dharma of calm, or whatever you have. So you're constantly reflecting in that way. And as I was saying last night, finding the refuge in, well, you know, where is your refuge? Where's your refuge in all this changing business? Well, from a Buddhist standpoint, it would be in knowing that which arises ceases, is not self. So just to do that in the beginning, you know, just to bring up that perception doesn't feel like much. Desire is much more compelling. But what the perception of change, or knowing that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, that's the accepting of life's changes. Whereas desire is the attempt to recreate the conditions and the characteristics and the qualities of the experience, to get something. And that very act of getting and going out from the center into sense experience is the delusion. So coming home, knowing change, reflecting on suffering, it's always a kind of coming home to this point, to this way. And then the strength and compulsions of our desire mind and delusions and obsessions, they begin to fall away. You know, they begin to somehow not be so powerful anymore, not be in our face all the time. So I think a, a sense of trust is very important. You know, what do you trust in? Do you trust in thought? What kind of thought do you trust in? Where does your faith hold? And I would say trust in awareness of change. Really work with that. Keep that foremost in consciousness. So Lompa Cha's way, this is uncertain. If you follow Lompa Cha's teachings, you can see in just reading his material, it's like there's a kind of constancy in his reflection. He says, do it all the time. This is uncertain, that's uncertain, this is uncertain. Do it all the time. And that's a kind of contemplative samadhi, isn't it? It's like he's really there, he's in the present, and he's bringing up this, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. And what happens if you do that? Only you can discover. You can believe or disbelieve that suggestion. If you believe it, you won't discover it. If you disbelieve it, you won't discover it. But if you try it, then you'll see, is it effective or not? And that trying has to be more than an intermittent experience once a week. You know, constancy is like, what am I faithful to? You know, what do I have faith in? What am I faithful to? And I'm faithful to this kind of contemplative attitude to things. Then you start to see the effects of that, because that perception begins to be stronger and stronger and stronger. And that perception is the perception that takes you out of the need to change things. Desire is the need to change things, and the perception of change is letting go of that need, because you know, because you can even see desire, can't you, as something which arises and ceases. And when you begin to see that craving arising and ceasing, you see desire cease, and not because you've been satisfied by changing the parameters of life, but because you were able to witness it as change. In the ceasing, you have the third noble truth. You have the intuition of what Nibbana is about, the cessation of craving, as opposed to the gratification of craving or the satisfying of craving. They're there, that's fine, nothing wrong with it, but to realize the end of craving, not as a final solution, but as a kind of constant, where when the sense of self ceases, you know, when thought ceases, what's that like? Or when the restlessness, and you just see it cease in the mind. So we're noting beginnings and endings, and in the cessation, there's peace. So we have this, I think all day today, and then we finish the retreat tomorrow at after breakfast. So what happens quite often now on a retreat is, especially if you've been here for much of the retreat, is the perception of time changes. So before the retreat, you think about, what am I going to do on the retreat? So there's the future, the becoming, to go to the retreat. Then as the retreat maybe begins to end, you think, what am I going to do next? So you have beginning and ending, and the sense of time coming and going, and that can be known, how the mind, like at the end of retreat, it begins to plan, what are you going to do next? The sense of self is born from time, and so on. And all in our kind of constancy then in the knowing flow of consciousness is to begin to really take refuge in the Buddha knowing Dharma as change. Just keep taking refuge in that way. And then the mind opens to that peaceful possibility. All right, let's do some sitting.